You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to the Ready Room, show number 63, A Deeper Appreciation of Her Captain. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Greg Harbin. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the American debut of Star Trek Catan, new Star Trek toys and collectibles from Diamond Select, plus we look at IDW's The Truth About Tribbles, as well as some movie news and rumors. Then in the feature, we're joined by Tristan Riddell to discuss the third season Enterprise episode, Twilight. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Greg. How are you this week?
Chris, I just woke up from an epic nap, actually, this afternoon, because it's the weekend of PAX. It's PAX in Seattle. Like, Thursday night, I found out that I was going to have a ticket to go, so I didn't even make plans. So I just sort of went, tried to make it happen, wandered around a lot. I'm beat. But I saw Wesley Crusher. He was like five feet away. So,
now, was he wearing his Technicolor sweater?
He wasn't, sadly. I wish he had been. I don't know why he wasn't. One of these days, I'm going to plan in advance and make sure I get him an actual Technicolor sweater that maybe I could knit myself, because I think he'd appreciate that. But no. He's actually transitioned completely out of being Wesley Crusher, and he's sort of embracing his new Big Bang Theory following and all of that. So it's kind of weird to see him now because he's nothing. He doesn't act like Wesley Crusher. He doesn't look like Wesley Crusher. It's only because I know that that's who he is that I'm able to make the connection.
Well, see, now this is a big difference between you and me. So everyone thinks that we are just, giant Star Trek geeks, right?
Right.
But you spent the weekend at a convention while I spent the weekend watching college football.
This is true.
But I have to say that you made the season opener for me much more entertaining with your wonderful insight into who you call the wolf guys.
Yeah, I mean those wolf guys. I mean obviously your team is the red people. From Alabama.
We're the red people.
Alabama red.
Yeah.
And yeah. I mean I thought that their game against the wolf guys was really fascinating. The wolf guys Wolverines, like the X-Men, I think.
They can't use their claws anymore. NCAA passed a new rule.
This is the thing. If you use your claws, that's not feet. It's obviously football. And I was noticing how good they were with their feet. They kept, I believe it's called punting. Punting?
Yes, it's a German word, punting.
they'd sort of screw around like right near their goal.
Right.
And then just kick the ball really far. And I was impressed. I didn't realize you could actually kick a football that far.
Right. Well, as we discovered, apparently Michigan was caught in a temporal causality loop where they would, as you put it, they had a staff meeting, right?
Yes,
and
staff meeting.
The coach told them, just dick around for three downs here and then kick the ball.
Kick the ball. Kick it like your life depends on it.
And then let's just do it all over again. So they were caught in a temporal causality loop for four quarters. And so it was a good weekend for me. We won our season opener 41-14. All right. Well, why don't we not bore our listeners anymore with college football, even if there is a temporal causality twist in it. And let's jump into our other stuff here. It seems, Greg, that our listeners enjoyed last week's show from what I can tell. Mm-hmm. And from last week's show has been born a new Ready Room drinking game, apparently, where you take a shot every time I say naked.
The thing is, before you, Chris, I didn't realize there were people who said that unironically. But I've been watching you, and I have yet to detect any irony. So I believe it, that when you say the naked now, you're not making a joke.
Oh, gosh. It's not a word that I walk around saying all the time, and so I didn't quite realize that pronunciation is there, but apparently it is, as the listeners have picked up on. So I'm glad everyone's enjoying that. We will be sure to try to talk about more naked characters on the Ready Room, just for your entertainment.
Yes, definitely. I'm really looking forward to talking about the Season 5 Enterprise episode, The Naked Future, Season yes. 6, The Naked Tomorrow. These are going to be fun discussions.
And of course, the classic, For the World is Hollow, and I Have Touched the Naked Guy.
Wasn't that a Bruce Springsteen song?
I'm pretty sure it was, yes. All right. So also from last week's show, generated a little bit of mail from Colin, who is not only a loyal listener going way back, but who is also a member of the Trek FM family, host of Trek News and Views and Deck 8. And of course, Charlene is a frequent guest on Trek News and Views with Colin. So he really enjoyed her take on Blink of an Eye last week. So Greg, Colin writes in, "Well, I have to say that the last episode was completely brilliant. The stories were interesting, and one of them was a foreshadowing of what was to come. One should always adhere to the omens when naked is mentioned at least 12 times before Charlene has entered the podcast. You should obviously enter the last part with shields at full and the oh my on standby. That said, I think even George would have struggled with what happened. Once again, we get to the last 5 minutes and Charlene lets rip with the complex vibrator. Cue me nearly choking on my tea. Thankfully, not Earl Grey, so I did not spill anything too precious, but boy, did I laugh out loud. I think, you know, I like to catch people on public transportation and make them freak out the other passengers. And
yes.
I think you are aware that Colin's job is he actually drives trains.
So oh, wow.
He's in the perfect position for that to happen.
Oh, goodness.
He goes on, Charlene is always an entertaining addition to any Ready Room. You just sit there listening for the inevitable decline in sexual content to occur. But this for sure knocked the previous gimp mask out of the park. This was for sure a Super Bowl touchdown. No other ball was in the park, on the field, or near the water. I think that's enough ball references for Greg.
Sports ball.
Chackie was well served as well, or to give him his Ready Room designation of Coco. So I think Colin pretty much summed up our last show.
He did. That was
in that email, Greg.
That was pretty good. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to the novel that I'm writing with Charlene, you know, 50 Shades of Coco. That's going to be okay. Quite interesting. So look forward to that. Newsstands.
Very it definitely soon. Is. All right. So thanks, Colin, for your message, as always. Okay, Greg, so you spent the weekend at the convention, and you picked up an item that many American Star Trek fans have really been waiting for, which has been available over in Germany for a while, and that is the Star Trek Catan game. So
yes.
Tell us. Now, you show me the box here on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
I've got a bit of unboxing to do here. So I can't really show our listeners. That's the only problem. But it's the Settlers of Catan game that everyone should be familiar with. If you're not familiar with Settlers of Catan, shame on you. So it's a board game where you basically are trying to settle an island. It's a lot like Lost, but with, you know, colonization. And the idea for this one is instead of an island, it's sort of a group of planets. And the art is fantastic. It looks like classic TOS stuff, in fact, too. I'd love to see them do a DS9 or TNG Catan as well, but this is classic TOS. It comes with these little miniatures that I'm going to show Chris here on the video of like little Enterprises. There's like a million of them here, and little star bases. Oh, man. What is this base called? It's the one from Star Trek 2, right?
Is that the Regula?
Yeah, I think it's the Regula space station. Yeah. So all these little guys you can put down, and it's got all the cards, you know. It's a really good board game already. Settlers of Catan is fantastic. And this has the addition of character cards as well. So, you know, you can have your James T. Kirk that adds a protection. And instead of getting, you know, wood and lumber and sheep and stuff like that, you've got oxygen and dilithium and that sort of thing as your resources. So, you know, it just puts a nice little spin on things for it.
They should at least have some animals in there, like goats, llamas, for example. I mean, what if you want to settle the, you know, Organian homeworld or something? You need those goats running around so you can paint them green.
That is quite true. Yeah, I'm kind of disappointed that there's not, you know, the triple card. That would be quite nice. And the triple card could be eliminated with the use of a glamour card.
That would be awesome. Now, one thing that we discovered there is very interesting is that on the board, there are four planets that you could choose from.
Oh, yes.
Designated by factions,
right.
Correct?
This is actually a PAX exclusive. This is why I spent $55 buying it at PAX rather than, I think it's like $30 if you buy it at Target, apparently. They didn't tell me that, but they told me, you know, there's a PAX exclusive and it's these score counters. And yes, you've got Klingon, you've got Romulan, you've got Federation, and then Vulcan. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but Vulcans are part of the Federation, I thought. That was my understanding.
Last time I checked. Yeah, I thought so.
Oh, goodness. I mean, couldn't you have had, you know, Vulcan, Romulus, Earth? I guess they'd call it the Klingon homeworld because this is TOS and they didn't know it was called Kronos yet. But I find that rather amusing. But I do like how the little score pieces are of those little symbols. You know, you've got the Federation symbol, you've got the Klingon symbol, you've got the Idik, and you've got the Romulus, the Romulan bird that's holding the two planets, as Tom Hardy says in the Nemesis trailer and nowhere in the film itself.
Oh, speaking of the Nemesis trailer, now, we had a discussion about this, right?
We did.
And tell me, what is your theory about the Nemesis trailer?
Well, I don't know if you've noticed, but the Nemesis, Star Trek Nemesis trailer, basically none of that footage is in the film itself. There's the shot of Picard and he says, you know, it was as if a part of me was taken away. That's not in the film. What happened there? And no, I mean, my theory is, you know, that Stuart Baird was like busy in the editing room and the trailer guys came in and were like, hey guys, Stu, we need some footage for the trailer. He's like, ah, get out of here. I'm too busy remodulating Laverne's voice. So they sort of just snuck in during the night and sort of got what's in the trash, all the stuff that Baird had already cut out of the film. And they basically put all of that together in just this mess of a trailer.
Right. Whatever they could scrape together, yeah. Right?
Yeah, there's some bits of like generations in there just for the hell of it. I don't know.
I like the part in the middle where that Klingon bird of prey explosion sneaks in.
Yeah, you know, why not? You've always got a exploding bird of prey. It's a Star Trek movie. It's even if it's not in there, Baird's going to put it in there at some point in the editing process.
And then right in the middle of the battle with the scimitar, they fly through the Dyson sphere doors.
Yes, and then, of course, they have to take a trip to the Badlands, as you do.
They're like, this is the last film, you know, it's our last chance to use all this stuff. Let's just go all out.
Badlands footage doesn't look that good blown up on the big screen, but, you know, maybe people forgot to wear the glasses or something.
That's right. All right, so what's your plan now for Star Trek, Catan? Do you have some people to play the game with, or are we going to try to do a on-camera play where I'm going to actually recreate the pieces on my side without having the game, and then we're going to play together?
I'm hoping we can find a way to do that. I do have a plan tomorrow to have a game day with David, Sci-Fi Commons, because it's actually Labor Day here in the States. It's one of those random holidays. And so we will be playing Catan and the Star Trek deck building game, as well, that I haven't played in ages. But of course, at Star Trek 13, Star Trek Las Vegas 2013, I'll be bringing all of these with me. And so hopefully we can get some big Trek FM groups together for playing all these games. So you can look forward to that for sure.
You know, we have so many things planned for Star Trek Las Vegas. Are we actually going to go to any of the sessions, or are we just going to sit in the lobby and do stuff the whole weekend?
I don't see any reason to go to any actual sessions. I mean, it's going to be all reported, you know, as exclusives on one of these fan sites. So why do we need to even bother being there for the panel itself?
Right. It's going to be easy to play the game too, you know, as we all walk around in our together in our staff meeting costume, because yes. We already have the table.
The table's right there.
It's already there. It means, you know, if we need to go get our soy chai latte,
yes,
we can keep playing the game as we walk over there, because the table goes with us.
Table goes with us.
All right. Well, this game, anyway, I'm a little bit confused about whether it's available yet to everyone in the U.S. or it was only at PAX, because the date I've seen for it was September 13th as a release date for the U.S.
My understanding is that they've got it at PAX this week. I think they also had it at Dragon Con. Don't quote me on that. But I think it's a convention exclusive, and a PAX exclusive is what I was told for that board. So if you didn't get it, shame on you. But then, starting in a couple weeks, you'll be able to get it at Target only, which is weird, because usually, I mean, there's a lot of these privately owned game stores that have, you know, Dominion and all of the, you know, other 30 versions of Catan. So it's surprising that they're not selling them to those stores. But if you've got a particular deal with Target, that's great, because it's going to increase the visibility of it. And they probably were able to sell a bunch of them to Target, and that's part of what helped them get it to the States.
Well, that probably also means a lower price for fans as well, because Target can buy them in large quantities, whereas, say, comic shops, for example, would only buy a few copies.
Right. And now, the guy told me that it's $55 at the con and then probably $50 at Target, although I'm being, according to this, people are finding it for like $29.99. So who knows? Go to your local Target in a week or two and see.
Yeah, we'll see if it's there. All right. Well, while we're talking about toys, we have another thing in the lineup today, Greg, about Diamond Select toys. Now, I noticed when we started the show that you have your plush Enterprise back there behind you today.
I do. I'm always playing with my plush Enterprise. Has everyone by now seen the video that I shot with the plush Enterprise with Michael Giacchino's Star Trek music?
Oh, that's right.
If people haven't seen that, we should put it in the show notes. Okay. I do love my plush Enterprise, bought for me by a lovely listener.
So to go with that plush Enterprise, Greg, you will be able, if you'd like to, get the Enterprise B with Captain Harriman sitting in the big chair.
Nice. Now it's not plush though. I think that's the only issue.
It's not plush, that's right. So you can't throw it across the room like you do with your other one.
And now it's about 16 inches long as well, right? So it's probably going to be a little smaller than this one. But that's, I mean, 16 inches is a reasonable size for a starship.
It is, especially, I mean, if you want to put them on your desk. Right. I have an Enterprise E, which is that I got back when First Contact came out.
Oh, nice.
It is, I think, longer than 16 inches. It's kind of actually hard for me to display in my studio. So
yeah, it gets kind of difficult. I mean, the plush Deep Space Nine that I want is like 3 feet around, and that's going to be really hard to hang anywhere without really getting in the way.
I would think so. All right, so Enterprise B is coming out.
Yeah.
Apparently, you can buy it today, and Diamond Select will send you the deflector dish next Tuesday.
Very nice. Yes, I was going to ask if it comes with a little piece that will break off in the Nexus and send Kirk out into space.
If it's authentic, then most definitely. Right?
Very good.
Also, the electronic Bird of Prey will be coming out. This one is 12.5 inches long by 19 inches wide.
Nice.
And it's packaged with a Try Me button, which apparently lets you blow the ship up on the shelf.
Very nice. Now, they have it set up so it blows up very perfectly with the bridge sort of spinning and blowing up right at the end. I guess we already discussed, but that's pretty much what happens every time. I think it's a defect, basically, in the Bird of Prey that causes it to blow up the same way every time. You just sort of bump something the wrong way, and it activates a series of explosives that are rigged inside of the Bird of Prey itself.
I could just see Klingon engineers designing the Bird of Prey and just doing test after test after test. They're like, we've got to get this right. You know, it has to have the same explosion pattern every time. It's kind of like our thing, you know?
Exactly.
It's like the blood wine. It's our thing.
Right. Every time that the bridge explodes first, like, gah!
and we didn't do it right. Back to the drawing board.
They stabbed that engineer through the heart. Yes. Because he got it wrong.
He got it wrong. But now they seem to have it down, because I have yet to see a bird of prey explode that didn't explode in the proper Klingon Board of Engineers approved way.
Right. So other things there, if you don't want to stab that Klingon engineer through the heart, you could use the electronic Klingon disruptor, which will also be coming out.
God, I love this. I might actually have to buy this disruptor. I've spoken before, right, of how much I love disintegration. It shocks me. It's like, yeah. So it's one of the cooler effects in Star Trek. And this is, I mean, it's a life-size disruptor, right? So I could carry it with me and all of that.
You could, yes.
I always figured if I was a mercenary, I mean, I know Gene Roddenberry, please stop spinning your grave. I know there's no such thing as a space pirate, space mercenaries. But if I were a space pirate, I would definitely carry a Klingon disruptor with me at all times.
Well, one way to escape from those space pirates would be in your Enterprise mini vehicle. And that is apparently coming out as well. And interestingly, this one says it has some hidden Jeffries tubes in it. And I can only imagine how small those must be inside a mini Enterprise.
I know. I am wondering if there's a mini Lieutenant Argyle in those mini hidden Jeffries tubes.
That's what I was thinking. He probably is in there. So that's coming as well. And then also, now you'll like this one, Greg. The retro cloth mirror universe Kirk and Spock assortment is coming as well.
This is pretty fantastic. Yeah. I just watched Mirror Mirror the other night. You can never watch Mirror Mirror enough, right? I mean, it is the best episode of TOS. So pretty much any chance you can sit down and watch it. So here we've got Mirror Kirk and Mirror Spock. This is Mirror Kirk and Vladimir Lenin, I believe.
Right. I have always thought that too.
Especially when he's there on like the bio bed and he's passed out. He looks like Lenin in the mausoleum. Like perfectly preserved. Oh,
he does, right?
He looks so creepy. So creepy. But definitely if as many of our listeners are, you are really, really into Mirror Spock, this is really gonna make your day.
What is it? You know, we have so many listeners who are really, really into Spock.
I know.
And not Zachary Quinto Spock, but Leonard Nimoy Spock. And they're even more into Mirror Spock.
Yeah. I don't quite understand. I mean, I know he's got like the good in him, and he leads to the whole thing. He's still kind of evil. I mean, he sticks the agonizer on people. He's still a pretty bad guy. I don't see personally what the attraction is. Now put Chris Pine on a motorcycle. Oh, goodness. Goodness me. Have you seen those set pictures? What's he shooting at? He's shooting the new Jack Ryan film.
Yeah.
Now that Star Trek is over. I'm just saying. I hope that there's a point at which he's in that green uniform, in the new film, because I love the green uniform. I love Chris Pine, and together, synergy.
Wait, I think you broke up there, Greg. Now, did I hear you right? Did you say you hope that he's out of the green uniform in the next Star Trek film?
Oh, goodness. Oh, Chris Pine.
Because I think that's pretty much what you tweeted, right?
I did pretty much tweet that, yes. Sometimes I like to tease a certain segment of my fan base, and you saw the picture, though, Chris. I mean, call me crazy.
I think in your own words, right? He's a sexy man. Is that right?
I think I did say that. But back to our story, though. I mean, look at this mirror Kirk. He's showing off quite a bit of skin in this. He looks like he's actually got the Ricardo Montalban chest going on.
Maybe he does. That's still floating around, right?
I think it is in the Paramount backlot.
All right. So you can get those if you want those as well. Quickly, we'll run down here. There are a few re-releases coming out. The electronic Enterprise E from Nemesis.
Right. Which is, of course, changed from Insurrection and changed from First Contact.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I know a lot of fans know. I don't know if all fans realize that the Enterprise E did evolve over the course of those films. Yeah.
I think if you put this, I hate calling it a toy, but if you put this replica next to the one you have on your desk, I think people really see there's quite a stark difference. I mean, just starting with starting with the paint scheme, but there's even different bits on it. The shape's been changed slightly. I mean, it's a very different ship.
So that one's out. The Wrath of Khan Enterprise will be re-released as well.
Very cool.
And the Star Trek communicator and phaser set will be re-released also.
I do like that ray gun. It's no Klingon disruptor, but I do like that ray gun effect of the TOS phaser.
So you can grab that one as you go out to explore City Alpha 5.
Yes.
As we will be doing in the future today.
Very soon.
All right. And then also available now, the retro Picard and Borg figures.
Yes. Although I'm looking at this Picard, on the website, I'm not actually sure if this is Picard or if this is actually not Patrick Stewart, because the likeness is really not quite spot on. I think this might be the guy that comes onto the Dork Trek to do the impression of Picard, buddy.
I think you're right. I mean, I think he's put on a little extra weight.
Yes, he has.
And he looks a little bit disoriented, right?
Yeah. It's like, what am I
Where
doing
am
here?
I, buddy?
When is the next staff meeting?
That's right. I thought this was the staff meeting. No, this is the poker game.
Right.
Oh, Beverly and Deanne, I'm sorry I walked in on your yoga session again.
Now, are these re-releases of, like, original 1980s figures? Is that what's going on here, or are they just made to look like it?
I believe that this is that line that we talked about last year, that they were inspired by the classic Mego figures.
Right, right.
So I think these may actually be new figures, but they've done the packaging up to look retro as well.
It's quite cool. It's quite cool. I mean, it's one of those things where, yes, I love playing with it, but the packaging is so cool that you almost want to just display it in the packaging.
Yeah, yeah. And I could be wrong here, but apparently I wasn't aware of this. I did not realize that Johnny Depp had played a Borg right after he filmed Edward Scissorhands, because doesn't it look like Edward Scissorhands with some Borg armor on?
Pretty much. They took Edward Scissorhands, stuck some white makeup and motherboards on him, and went ahead and filmed it.
This sure looks that way. All right. Well, we'll have a link to this in the show notes if you want to go and get a rundown of all these toys here.
Well, Chris, I mean that's probably enough about fun and games and toys. What is this? The game episode? I don't know. We've been talking about Catan and
we haven't talked about toys or games, you know, in quite a while. So
it has been some time. Well, there is something we've been kind of missing over the past, well, I guess just the past week, is the second episode of the Tribble arc on the comic actually was released, and you and I have read it at this point.
Yeah, it's interesting there that you referred to it as the second episode.
Yeah, I know.
So you are thinking of these comics like an episode.
I really am. I mean, it's the continuation of the JJ verse for me. Good or bad, I'm taking them as this is what's going on that's new. This is what's going on that's new in Star Trek right now. So I guess I shouldn't call it the new episode. I mean, it is. I mean, it's based on The Trouble with Tribbles. This is called, I think, The Truth About Tribbles.
It's called The Truth About Tribbles. And it's actually a good name, because one thing we do find out in here is a little bit more about the Tribbles themselves. Mm-hmm. I started to call them a race, but what would they be? More a species?
I guess they are a species. They're not humanoid. Not
right,
yet, at
and they least. They don't have spaceships, and at least not that I know of.
Right. Yeah.
Do you think if they had spaceships, would they have like hair all over the ship? Not fur, not like the fur covered Ferengi ships,
right,
but the like actual wild hair going out. And then when they fly at warp speed, it's like waving in the background. Yeah.
I don't know.
And in battle, their ships would just suddenly multiply.
Yes. Captain, I see five. Wait, no, 10. Wait, there are 15 triple ships. There are 50 triple ships, Captain.
It's like the Tholian web, yes, except they surround you with more and more ships until you're in this giant hairball.
Yes, giant hairball in space. Well, actually, so in this episode, it's completely different, I would say, from the original David Gerard script and an episode. They don't go to... Was it K-9? Or am I getting that confused with a Doctor Who reference? What was the name of the space station?
Oh, the Deep Space Station, yeah. K-7, yeah.
K-7, yes. Affirmative. Right.
There are no dogs on the station.
Right. But so in this one, instead of going there, they actually go to the Tribble homeworld.
Right.
Which looks like it's out of one of the Star Wars prequels. It's all blue and green and pink and lush forest. I guess it could look like Mass Effect if anybody's played that game.
Yeah, it did look that way. But it was interesting that they go to the actual Tribble homeworld.
Yeah.
And of course, I guess we should say real quick here, spoiler alerts.
Yeah.
If you're planning to read this, we're not going to give away every detail of the comic here, but in order to talk about it, we have to mention a few things.
We do. So,
the Klingons have been there because, I mean, as we know from Deep Space Nine, not just Deep Space Nine, from the original series too, mm-hmm. that the Klingons and the Tribbles are sworn enemies of the Klingons.
Yes.
Or vice versa. So the Klingons have gone there to eradicate.
I like the idea that the Klingons are the sworn enemy of the Tribbles. They have sort of a Tribble war council.
There is.
And
yes,
we must invade the Klingons.
That's right. Find a way to get onto one of their ships. Then eat everything you can find.
Yes. Oh, man.
They start feeding the baby Tribbles gach from birth so that they've acquired the taste for it. Because the last thing you want when you're on a mission like that is to get on the ship and find out that you just can't take the food, right?
Right, right. Now, I think we're actually skipping what happened in the beginning, right? Because Scotty is sort of experimenting with more crazy beaming technology.
Well, he's trying to get Porthos back, right?
Well, okay, I don't think it's technically Porthos because we're going to get letters. It is another beagle that Archer, because Porthos would be dead by now. I mean, I understand people are living longer, probably dogs are living longer.
No, you're forgetting, Greg, a ready room from long ago. Porthos is cybernetic at this point, remember?
That's true. Porthos
He's
can never die.
He's got the tail attachment, right?
This is
yes.
true. Now, I did want to ask, Chris, did you notice that there was a bit of a sneaky reference in this part of the comic? Did you notice what Scotty's nephew's name is?
Oh, you know, I actually didn't pay attention to that.
He's actually named Chris, which is not, I'm assuming, a reference to you, but it's a reference, I'm assuming, to Chris Doohan, who's James Doohan's son, who's
right.
pretty much in everything. He was yes. actually in the latest Star Trek movie as a transporter chief.
Right.
So that I found that amusing. He's always worming his way into stuff. So basically, Scotty beams a Tribble to Starfleet Command, to his nephew. Really, beaming technology has taken a grand leap forward in the JJ-verse.
They're really doing stuff. Right?
They can beam, like, from a planet to a ship at warp. They can beam, you know, from a ship at warp into, you know, back to Earth. They can beam people into water, apparently, so that Scotty can have a bit of comic relief.
Not only can they beam people from a ship traveling at warp back to Earth, but they can beam people from a ship traveling at warp on the far side of the galaxy all the way back to Earth. Now, think about how many episodes of Star Trek would have never happened if the transporters had that kind of range.
I know.
Because normally, it's like you're in the ship, and you can look out the window and you can see the planet, but we're not in transporter range for another 3 minutes. Oh my God.
Transporter range is crazy. There's always like, if there's anything like an ion storm, that immediately shuts down all transporters. Like, don't even try it. There's no way it's going to work. And that's even, you know, Voyager. That's with the 24th century transporters. But no, Scotty can beam pretty much whatever he wants, using just your regular old 23rd century transporter technology.
It's amazing the things that happen in this Abrams verse. But anyway, he does beam a Tribble back to Earth. And this is a Tribble. He thinks it's harmless. This is before they discover the homeworld and they find out what's going on with these Tribbles.
Right. And of course, this is like Enterprise, where we never say the word Tribble because no one knows they're called Tribbles. So they're always like the fur balls or the little monsters.
Don't they actually give them the name towards the end?
They give them, I think they just call them Trouble.
Oh, yes. That's
so it's a little joke there on the original name.
So without giving away the whole story to everyone, obviously, because they want to go read it, what did you think, though, about the overall story here? Because they are finally really diverging from the Prime timeline. Did you enjoy this take on Tribbles?
I thought it was interesting. It was an interesting way of doing the story differently. It's still pretty much a comedic episode like the original one was. But it's more tech in the tech. It's more of a Scotty story about beaming. I don't know. It's weird. I'm actually having kind of a hard time getting my head around it because it is so different from the original.
I just didn't think about it as being connected to the original in any way. Mm. I just thought about it as, here's a story about Tribbles. It takes into account everything that we know about Tribbles, including their relationship with the Klingons, how they reproduce, and it filled in a lot of the blanks in terms of why they reproduce.
Yes.
And I did like spoiler alert, I won't give it all away, but I did like how the Starfleet apparently has standard issue bug sprayers.
Yes.
that they walk around with. And I like that Starfleet puts their logo on everything.
They do. They put their logo on every single thing. Works for me.
I can just imagine on the Enterprise, like you go into to 10 Forward and you get some chopsticks.
Right.
And they probably have like little Starfleet insignia on each chopstick.
That's very true. Oh, man. I guess what I like about this episode is that it sort of presents a problem and then presents a solution to the problem. And it tells it puts in funny little things along the way. It feels very much like a traditional, like typical middle of the season episode of Star Trek, especially one of the newer shows. And it really highlights Scotty. And I love this new Simon Pegg Scotty. He's obviously quite different from Doohan. Although I mean, old Scotty was pretty good, but I do like this version of him where he's more overtly funny. This really highlights him and lets him get out of his shell and take over an episode and really solve a problem, which is quite cool.
Yeah, I like this Scotty too. Now, I'm sure we're going to get a bit of hate mail for that comment right there, because I know there are a lot of fans that really hate Simon Pegg's take on Scotty.
I'm sure there are.
I don't know. I think you can't judge from one film to start with. Clearly, he was there to be a bit of comic relief to what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that this Scotty captures what's great about Scotty from James Doohan's Scotty, as well as adding a little bit of comedy to it as well. So I like it. But
yeah, I like it. I like his little hat he wears, the beanie that he has on for a lot of it. Sells me the character, and I really hope they delve more into Scotty, let him do stuff like this in the new movie. One thing I like about the comic existing is that they can do an episode like this where it's focused on one of the lesser characters, because we've done the big Spock episode, we've done the big Kirk shows, even in the comic. So it's good to sit back and do this. Now I'm looking forward to the next one. It's all going to be about Uhura hugging people. That's going to be really exciting.
Yeah, that's right. I'm looking forward to that one, too. According to what I've been reading, it's going to be a remake of A Piece of the Action.
Right, there you go. Perfect. I was actually going to say, I think we're going to talk about canon, but when are we going to see that? I want to see the Piece of the Action remake in the IDW comics, just apropos of nothing. I love that storyline. I think they could do some really fun stuff by expanding the universe. We got some interesting stuff coming up. The next one is called The Red Shirt's Tale. And it's sort of about it's sort of like a behind the scenes look. What was that episode of Next Gen?
What, Lower Decks?
Lower Decks. So it's sort of like a Lower Decks. And then we've got a prequel of sorts where it's another Scotty episode where he meets Keenzer for the first time. So doing a couple sort of side projects. What I'm really looking forward to, though, is November, because we're finally going to get the Mirror Mirror remake.
Oh, that's right.
In the JJ-verse.
We talked about that in the past, right? Was it last week or the week before we talked about what will the JJ Mirror Universe be like?
Yes, yes.
Right.
And that, I just cannot wait for it. November cannot get here fast enough. Get Chris Pine finally in that green uniform or out of it, whatever.
I'm pretty sure that JJ Mirror Uhura has a hug aversion.
Probably.
It's actually some kind of like mental disorder where she just can't touch other people.
Right. I'm really looking forward to the Tantalus beam or the Tantalus field, because it's pretty much just all going to be lens flares. You're sort of standing there and, and you're gone.
They put you in a booth and they just subject you to constant lens flares.
Well, that's the new agony booth, is just constant lens flares. It's just J.J. Abrams sort of waving an iPad in front of your face.
That's right. So essentially, what, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, we were all subjected to the Tantalus field, right?
Pretty much,
theater.
Yes. How creepy is that? We need to do a Mirror Mirror episode. How creepy is it that Mirror Kirk has like a TV in his office that he can just press a button and just make people disappear?
Right.
That's terrible. And then apparently it's okay because Kirk's girlfriend, like the captain's woman, just does it to save them. It's like, no, she just killed four people, Kirk. Like, really? Anyway, we'll have to talk about Mirror Mirror in the future.
That's called setting up the Deus Ex Machina at the beginning of the episode. It's like, I have no idea how we're going to get out of this at the end. So let's put a TV in the captain's quarters. And if you press it, everyone vanishes. So then at the end, we'll just go back to it, right?
Exactly.
A lot of forethought there. Oh, so. Man. So, Greg, we've talked about bad guys quite a bit on past shows, as we've speculated on just who Benedict Cumberbatch is playing in the next movie.
Yes.
And we've watched reporters try and try and try to trick him into revealing that he's playing Khan. And, well, he was talking recently with Shortlist, and he said he's basically bored at this point with denying that he's Khan.
Well, here's the thing, Benny. Can I call you Benny? Benny?
Oh, sure.
Here's the thing, Benny. We're tired of you denying it, too. Like, seriously, we're, we're what, 6 months out from the film being released? Maybe 8 or 9 months? We should know who he's playing by now. At this point, it's just silly not to know. I mean, we know who he's playing in The Hobbit, even though that's not coming out for a while. Who waits to announce the name of a major character until after filming is done? It's just getting silly at this point.
It is. So, do you think he's playing Khan at this point? Do you think he's playing Sherlock? Is he Moriarty?
I had this conversation with a group of comics, and, you know, Star Trek always comes up whenever you get a group of young people together. And, you know, someone said, oh, it's not Khan. And I'm just saying, at this point, I don't know. Someone said, well, Simon Pegg says it's not Khan. Like, I don't believe anything Simon Pegg says anymore. But really, at this point, Cumberbatch could be playing anybody. He could be playing Riley, and I'd be happy.
Riley.
At this point. I do think he's Khan. But this, again, this isn't even... It's not a denial. It's just a, I'm sick of denying it.
Right. Oh, yeah, I don't know at this point either. Could be Khan, could be Gary Mitchell. We'll just see. But they've got to announce it soon. I mean, it's just getting... Just tell us already, right?
I don't understand. How can you just not say who it is?
I think you've gotten all the mileage that you can get out of this at this point. Now you're just irritating the fan base.
The thing is, at this point, if there's going to be a backlash, you need to be able to have a chance to react to the backlash.
Right.
Set up the ad campaign to answer fans' annoyances. The longer you put that off, the more... I mean, if they announce in April that it's Khan, people are just going to explode and hate it, and no one's going to see the film because it's going to be so fresh in their mind that this was sprung on them at the last minute.
Yeah. Yeah, give people time to be okay with it.
Right.
It just, you know, it's okay. You can watch the movie even if he's Khan. The one thing I know is that they're not going to do a remake of The Wrath of Khan. And
right.
For me, if he were playing Khan, my biggest concern would be that they were just simply doing a remake of the second original cast movie.
Yeah.
And they're not going to do that. Yeah. So,
well, as we saw with The Truth About Tribbles, they can take an original series episode and just do it completely differently. There's nothing keeping them from doing that. So if they changed, if they even took Space Seed and changed it the amount that they changed the Tribble episode, it's a completely different storyline. So you're not going to be bored. And Cannonbotch could play Khan and it would be just fine. I mean,
yeah.
But I mean, I don't know. We know he's somebody from canon, but there's so many people that he could be. I mean, there's so many canon characters from TOS because pretty much every episode has a new character in it.
Yeah. Well, I know he's not the salt vampire. That's at least something that I know.
That's probably true. He's probably not Harry or Henry Mudd.
Right. Or Howard Mudd. He's one of the brothers.
I think you're thinking of Howard the Duck. Kind of got
disowned by the family. But he's not in the band. Let's just put
it that way. No, he's not in the band. Well, aside from Cannonbotch, sick of denying he's Khan, Chris Pine, as we said, has moved on from Star Trek. He's now shooting the new Jack Ryan movie with Kenneth Branagh, and that's gonna be an interesting thing. I do like that Chris Pine is sort of being more than just Kirk. Obviously, not being in a weekly TV show helps that. But you know, when Shatner was doing the Star Trek films, he wasn't really doing anything else. And during the hiatuses from the TV show, he wasn't really doing anything else. His career kind of went full on Kirk.
It was, yeah. That became his identity for so long. But so in this one, Chris Pine talks about, he was talking to an Irish news outlet called RTE.
You have to put an Irish RTE. No, that's horrible. That's pirate. How do you do Irish for letters? That's wow. RTE. Sorry. Let me get some Guinness and have a pint of it, and maybe I'll be able to do the accent.
Oh, this is going to be great because, you know, we actually have some Irish listeners, so I can't
wait to
get their mail from after this episode.
RTE.
Oh, so Pine tells them that he feels that the stakes are a bit bigger this time around. There's a little more pressure on him and the cast.
Oh, I thought he was saying that there were giant vampires that they're going to have to stab with giant stakes.
Well, you never know. You know, Twilight is really big. And, you know, the studio, as UPN proved, you know, by combining Star Trek with World Wrestling Entertainment, the studio's not above combining two popular things.
Well, this is why you said Cannonbotch isn't playing the salt vampire. I think it makes perfect sense. I mean, imagine, you know, there's sort of a love triangle between Spock and Uhura and the salt vampire. Sort of like an Edward Jacob thing going on.
Right. That could work. Uhura is always coming up and accusing Spock of, you know, spending some quality time with the salt vampire. And
he denies it. Uhura and the salt vampire. Maybe it's like a circular. I don't know who's sleeping with whom at this point.
It's right. Well, he's always denying it. And Uhura's saying, look, Spocky, you know, I can clearly see the giant red suction marks on your neck.
Right. Yes.
So unless you and Jimmy have been doing something that I don't know about, I think you've been with the salt vampire.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to deny that you've not been with the salt vampire.
All right. Well, climbing back out of our rat hole here, Craig, back to what we're actually talking about. So Chris Pine, quoting him in the interview, he says that the first one, we didn't have much to lose because we didn't have much to lose. All right. Well, way to go, Pine. I got you. I'm with you there.
There you go.
It was either going to be a great big hit and surprise everybody, or it was going to fall down the drain and no one would have thought twice about it. And it just so happened it was pretty well received. Yeah, I think $250 million or so qualifies as pretty well received.
Yeah, I think people pretty much emphatically said that, yes, we like this Star Trek.
I think so. And he says, so going into this one, I was so excited that we'd brought all these new fans to the franchise that I wanted to do my job to make sure they come back. And I always wanted to do justice to my fellow actors and to the writers because it's such a good story.
So basically, he's saying he sort of just phoned it in the first one.
Right. That's what I was thinking while I was reading it. It's like, yeah, you know, we didn't have anything to lose the first time. So I just went in and I just kind of half-assed it. But but this time, I really gonna do my job.
But absolutely, I understand. I mean, you look at, you know, Wrath of Khan, and there you've got all the characters doing their job. But when at the very beginning of Star Trek, they didn't know their characters quite as well. They weren't quite as comfortable. They weren't throwing themselves into the role. It makes perfect sense that when it was Pine's first film, he didn't entirely, not his first film, but his first time playing Kirk.
Right.
He's not going to entirely be able to throw himself into it because he's still trying to work out who this character is and what the script is and why it doesn't make any sense.
Right. But I think he did a good job. I think all the actors did a good job in the first movie.
Pine's fantastic.
I didn't feel like anyone was phoning it in or was uncomfortable in the roles.
No, but myself. I think we're going to see a new level in this one where they're really feeling comfortable and just going for it.
Yeah, exactly. Unless the 4-year layoff has them, they've forgotten everything about
the characters. That's entirely possible. Uhura doesn't remember how to hug people.
Need a lot of practice on the set. I think you volunteered for that, didn't you?
I did. Zoe, hug me pretty much anytime you want. If you need practice or whatever.
All right. So he goes on about a third film in the series, kind of teasing on that. He says, knowing these guys, there's always a way to make some more installments. I'm sure they've built in something. I'm just not smart enough to have seen it. But I'm sure there's a way. What do I know from the start in terms of structure? They've had an idea of where they want to take the whole thing, just like a television series. And I'm very excited about part two.
You must not have been paying attention where at the end of the script, before Spock goes into the dilithium chamber, and he sort of puts his hand up on Carl Urban's face and says, you know, remember. Right. And then he goes and he dies and they sort of put him onto the Genesis planet. I mean, when you're reading the script, it's kind of obvious, but I guess he didn't quite understand where this is going.
He didn't get that part, you know. Yeah. He's too young to have seen the original Wrath of Khan. So.
That's really true. So when they do the remake, he's a little lost. Thinks this is, well, that's pretty much all it, because Khan's dead, right?
Yeah, a little bit. To start the third season of Enterprise, the studio gave us a season-long story arc involving the Zindi, a race we had never seen before, who had been threatening Earth. And about a third of the way through that season, we got to see a possible outcome of where the storyline would lead us in the episode Twilight, as we jump 12 years into the future to find out what happened to to Archer's mission, and also, well, basically how he lost his memories but gained a Vulcan girlfriend. And to help us talk about that, of course, Greg is here, and we have international sex symbol, host of Hyper Channel, and MC of the Star Trek Question of the Day, Tristan Riddell. Hello, Tristan.
Hey, guys. It's good to be back, and I'm really glad that that whole international sex symbol thing is not dying out quickly, because I, frankly, I just don't get tired of it.
I keep calling you the ISS Tristan Riddell, and I really enjoy that. We're actually having a bit of a fight on Twitter over who gets to be XO of the ISS Tristan Riddell.
That's true. Matt Hansen is pretty much the leader right now, because he definitely sucks up to me the most when it comes to, like, he wanted me to come on Delta Quadrant really bad. And so, and he wants the XO position really bad. Right. So, I mean, I don't know. He's in the run. Yeah. And also, you know, he's a fantastic nerd.
Wait until I stick him in the agony booth, and then we'll see who's XO.
That's true.
But speaking of that, the question of the day, Tristan, there was an interesting, like, sort of explosion that happened. What day was that? Was that Wednesday or Thursday this week?
Yeah, that was a couple of days ago. What did you call it? The great canon debate
of August 2012. Yes,
of August 2012. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember. How did that even start? Oh, you were sort of in an argument with somebody on Twitter about, what was it? It was Star Trek Online, whether or not that was, quote,
that's
canon.
Right. Yeah, that
yeah,
was it.
Yeah, actually, it started on G+, actually, which is a social network that I almost always forget about,
yes.
But I have it linked with my Twitter.
It's amazing, and you found someone over there on G+ to talk about this with you.
I know, right? I mean, it's like a desert on that social network. But my question of the days gets sent to Google+, and every once in a while I'll log into the email and it says I have a few notifications.
Right.
And this, one time I said, I think the question was, who would you like the next Enterprise captain to be? And it
right.
was, I just wanted people to pick a random actor that they liked or who they think would be a good, you know, Enterprise captain.
Right.
And then one person chimed in and said, oh, do you mean the Enterprise F? Because if it's the Enterprise S, then it has to be the person that they chose in STO, Star Trek Online.
God.
And I said, I was like, well, I didn't mean that specifically, just, you know, like an actor that you would like. And he's like, well, it would have to be the guy in Enterprise F because STO is canon,
right.
and you can't disregard canon.
Right. This is Trekkie Van Hoat. I don't know if anyone listens to the Back to Work podcast, but it's like, so, in Star Trek Online, there's the Enterprise F, and so... Yeah, sometimes you run into that guy.
It was totally that guy, and I was trying to be really nice, and I was saying, well, you know, I personally don't, you know, I don't consider it canon because I never thought it was, but then I got yelled at by six people saying, oh no, it's canon, all of it is canon.
Right, so then the tweet I see is from you, and you're basically just like, I got cussed out by somebody just for saying, maybe it's Star Trek Online's not canon. And then the next thing I know,
exactly.
At Star Trek is replying to you.
That's what happens. Yeah, I go to you and I complain and I say, I just got blocked by this guy. And to make a long story short, all of a sudden Dayton Ward chimes in and says that canon should be stricken from the dictionary.
Right.
And then the best thing that could ever happen to a nerd online... At Star Trek,
yes.
The governing body of Star Trek itself sides with
yes.
me and says the other guy is an
right.
idiot. And I just really hope he sees it. I really hope he finds out. And anyone who's listening to this, STO is not canon. It never was
right.
declared as canon. The governing body of Star Trek says it's not. The only thing that is the Enterprise F ship design.
Right.
That's the thing that...
that's it.
The studio did say that the Enterprise F is canon because it was the contest
yes.
they ran. And the contest
right.
was, help us design the next canon Enterprise.
But that doesn't mean that whoever's running the ship is the actual person
right,
in the Star Trek
right.
universe.
Exactly.
Now, and I would like...
Right, so thank you for letting me go on a tirade about that.
I would actually like
let
to
let me
have
just
to,
say...
Yeah. No, go ahead.
I mean, in my canon... Those Breen were taking ice showers.
Yes, exactly.
When Kira
exactly.
and Dukat
exactly.
stole
their
uniforms.
We all have our personal canon.
We all have our personal canon.
Oh, yeah, I was talking about my personal canon for DS9 Season 7, where Jadzia never dies, and Sisko comes back, like, the next day.
No, he comes back yesterday.
He comes back yesterday. I don't know how that quite
yesterday.
Works with the continuity. but, yeah, I think we can all have our personal canon for the stuff that's not... specifically shown on screen. Or even if there is stuff that's shown on screen, we can still have our own worries and beliefs. Like, it's not that big a deal. I think that I'd love to have Dayton Warden on our show sometime and have a little bit where we talk about canon, because he writes novels in the Star Trek universe, but he's not out there saying, well, my book should be thought of as canon by everyone.
You know, actually, Dayton and I, we talked about that canon versus non-canon bit in the novels a while back when on a Matterstream episode when we talked about...
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, we talked about his book, That Which Divides, but we also just talked about writing Star Trek novels in general. And we talked a little bit about canon versus non-canon. So if you go back and catch that episode and go to iTunes and search for Matterstream, it's up there. You'll find it.
All right, pretty much.
Yeah, we talked about that.
Pretty much the only thing we're sure is completely canon is, of course, Benedict Cumberbatch from the new Star Trek movie.
It's right in his name.
It's in his name. How can you argue with it?
You can't deny it. He's Cumberbatch. All right. Well, why don't we bring it back around to the episode that we're going to talk about today, Twilight.
Oh, of course, now, Greg.
Of course, yes, the episode.
I'm actually not aware of these details, but apparently there was some interesting way in which you approached the ISS.
Well, yeah, because I did now. Because unlike you, Tristan actually lives in the same country as me. I can actually text message him. So I invited him on to say, hey Tristan, we're doing Twilight. What did you actually say back to me, Tristan?
Oh, well... Yeah, I said, oh man, that's so fantastic. That's probably my favorite Enterprise episode of all time. And Greg responds back to me, oh, that's great, because I don't even remember it. And I said, Greg, once you watch this episode, I hope you understand why I'm laughing so hard right now.
I had no idea, because I didn't.
And then like 3 days later.
3 days later. There's no more text between us. We don't see anything else. 3 days later. I come back and like, yes, now I see why you're laughing.
It totally reminded me of Data in Generations when he says, like, it's like, Geordi, remember when you were on the bridge? I get
the
it.
The clown in the gorilla suit has to go.
Okay, well, I'm interested to hear the background of this, because for me, I chose this episode because I remembered it as being one of my favorite episodes of Enterprise. I have to say that having rewatched it twice over the past couple of days, that I had a little bit different take on it now than as what I remember when I watched it when it first came on. So I'm really curious to hear your thoughts on it as well.
Yeah, it's an interesting, I don't know how we want to jump into it, but it's one of those episodes sort of in the vein of Year of Hell or All Good Things, where we're sort of seeing a large swatch of Star Trek. We're seeing earlier on, we're seeing later, because most Star Trek episodes take place, unless it's that episode where they meet Space Jesus on Next Gen that takes place over like 3 months. Most of the episodes are just a couple days long, and we're learning more about the characters. But here we see like this large, like, what if story. And if nothing else, I love episodes that let us do that.
Yeah, I think the reason why I latched onto this episode is because I love it when we jump forward and, you know, and see what could have been or see what might have been. And I'm not that big of a fan of going backwards, but I love it when we get a sneak peek. And even though there are some complaints about a big reset button, if you would call this a reset button, it's like the greatest reset button of all time, because like you guys said, it was in the vein of All Good Things and Year of Hell and things like that. Mm-hmm. And if anything, it was fantastic to see Archer in a Vulcan haircut.
That's very true.
That's true. Sort of chopped. He was really rocking that haircut.
I love the idea that T'Pol cuts his hair now, so it's got a Vulcan twinge to it.
I just picture T'Pol putting a bowl on his head and then cutting his hair, and then afterwards using that bowl to make breakfast for him.
Exactly. That's probably her routine.
I can't wait to talk about her routine later in the show, actually.
I do like when he comes in and she says, Jonathan, sit down.
Right.
So his eyes, you called me Jonathan.
He's so confused. Can we?
You called me by my Christian name.
Should we go ahead and jump in and talk about it? I mean, they're on SETI Alpha 5.
This is SETI Alpha 5.
T'Pol!
I'm saving mine for later.
But yeah, I mean, jumping in, one, I'm with you, Tristan, that I think the reason why I've always remembered this as being one of my favorite episodes of Enterprise is because I also do like these stories where they jump ahead and we kind of see what if. And to, well, I'll talk about the reset button at the end because I don't want to get too far ahead on that. But this was, I thought the positioning of this episode in the third season was interesting because we were far enough into the whole Zindi conflict and the search for the weapon to be invested a bit in the outcome of the whole mission. And so seeing at this point one possible outcome of the mission, I thought was very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's
and
of,
I thought it was...
Yeah, it ups the stakes for us, for the Zindi arc. It early on says, you know, if they fail, this is what could happen.
Right, right. And I thought it was interesting to see the dynamic between Archer and T'Pol in the future when they're no longer within that command structure as well. And after their relationship had evolved.
Yes, evolved. Which, how far did it evolve?
I love T'Pol's look that she gives him when he asks, how far has it evolved?
I like,
she doesn't really answer the question.
I like the idea, though. I mean, obviously, this is sort of like the notebook in space, where T'Pol sort of is telling Archer this story, and then James Garner shows up. Anyway, but she says, you know, sometimes I don't tell you the whole story. I like the idea that some mornings she just sort of wakes up in bed with Archer, and she's naked. And, you know, they have sex and,
you know, she's naked, right?
By breakfast, Archer figures, like, either this is an awesome dream or, like, a really awesome parallel universe, and I'm just going to go with it. And that's just an easier way for T'Pol to deal with the whole senile Archer situation.
I always thought it was much more like 50 First Dates with Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore, right, where, like, he gets really physical really fast with her. And she goes like, what are you doing? Like, this is, you know, I barely know you. He's like, come on. Like, you know, we've been going out for like 6 months. Right? It's time for you to give and take a little. I bet you T'Pol gets that way too. Especially on her seventh year.
Exactly. This would be a good time for us to talk about Pon Farr, but let's not. Let's leave that for another episode.
I knew we should have had Shar on the show.
I know
this week.
I know. She would have. She, I hear, is the leading expert in Pon Farr, of course, from an educational standpoint.
Yes, absolutely. She is an educator.
Not just Pon Farr itself, but also the wide range of Pon Farr paraphernalia that's available on Vulcan.
Right, right,
Wow.
The green-lit district, if you will.
Okay, all right. So, as we go along in this story, though, watching it now versus when it first came on, I think one thing that pulled me out of my love for the episode a little bit is that I saw too many other episodes in this episode. I think it's the problem that when you've done so many episodes, I mean, this episode is the 688th episode of Star Trek. And when you have done that many episodes, I think it's a little bit difficult for it not to come across as derivative at times.
Yeah.
And
well, I mean, this had started as a Voyager episode, and you know, it's never a good sign when they're dipping into scripts from previous series, as we've seen with Devil's Due or The Naked Now.
Right. So here you're talking about. Oh gosh, this is for our drinking game, right?
I know.
So here you're talking about the Voyager episode Resolutions, right? Where Kathy and Coco are stranded on that planet together. And I think at some point they do get naked.
That's very true. No, but literally this episode itself started as a Voyager episode that they never produced.
Yeah, it was pitched to kind of Catherine to be the one in Archer's place and Chakotay to be in T'Pol's place, but the writer said that he liked it as T'Pol and Archer anyway, better anyway.
Right. I mean, it would have been an interesting Voyager episode, I suppose. Let's get Kathy and Coco together again in the future. I mean, it probably works better as an Enterprise episode, but I think, yeah, that's the deal. It does feel derivative. I feel like we've done this before. If it's not Resolutions or it's not All Good Things, there's plenty of episodes that have gone down this road before.
But I kind of like how we Tarantino it at the beginning, where we kind of start with the middle.
Oh, yeah.
And then go with the beginning and then the end. Yeah. I like that kind of non-linear structure. You don't see that too often, I don't think, in Star Trek.
No, I mean, it's much more popular in Battlestar, which we're going to talk about in a minute, probably.
So say we all.
But yeah, I love it because it's...
We always do.
So say we all.
We always manage to. But you've got Archer bursting onto the bridge and, you know, there's T'Pol. She's like...
Naked.
T'Pol sort of...
Oh, what have we started
Yeah, he does.
Here?
He does have his shirt off. I thought you were saying T'Pol was naked. That's quite an interesting command decision. But no, Archer bursts on the bridge half naked, as captains tend to do. And before you know it, Earth is being destroyed. I mean, anytime you can have the teaser of your film have Earth blow up, that's pretty good. I mean, that's good TV right there.
Well, it's like in Scorpion, the really short teaser where the Borg cubes blow
up. Just show the Borg cube. Like, boom. Yeah.
Yeah. You're like, what?
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah, it pulls you in.
So, I mean, if nothing else, this show probably has one of the best teasers in Star Trek history, I would say. Especially, at least...
I think Star Trek is known for having really great hooks.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like... And that's one thing that I really enjoyed about the Abrams adaptation is that he knew that Star Trek was known for its great teasers, great hooks, and then he created a movie that had one of the best action and emotional hooks of all time in cinematic.
It's phenomenal.
You know,
yeah.
Telling, yeah.
Which actually, they weren't originally, they were going to start with Spock being born, weren't they? And then
they
eventually figured out, well, no, this makes a lot more sense as a dramatic beginning.
Yeah, they made a lot of good decisions in the editing on that. I mean, even the music. You know, they actually introduce the Star Trek theme until later on in the movie, in the JJ movie. But they were going to have it right at the beginning originally. And so that was good.
Made a lot of really good decisions.
But what it got me here was that early on, there's the whole mysterious anomaly on the ship.
Yeah.
In the corridor with Archer and T'Pol. And it's never really explained what that is. And it just...
It is a writer's toy chest for this season. It is fantastic because they say like, oh yeah, once we like in the very first episode, like once we enter this, you know, this area of space, anything can happen.
Right.
You know, like the rules of physics don't apply, and so the writers can just say, oh, anomaly.
Wasn't that the line? It's like there's some sort of strange disturbance on the ship. I believe it's caused by an anomaly. It's like, what do you mean it was caused by an anomaly? That's like saying, I don't know, my clothes are dirty. I think it's caused by dirt. It's like, yes, that's typically when something unexplained happens in space, we call that an anomaly. Now, explain what that it is, please. Go have Geordi go look at it with his phaser. He can figure it out. Don't just call it an anomaly and move on. Yes, I concur as well. It is, in fact, an anomaly.
It's like when Harry Kim says, there's something out there.
Yes. Captain, you have to get down here and see this. It's really interesting.
Oh, I love that. I love in Star Trek. Because how often would that happen in real life? Like if I just called up my boss and I said, hey, man, you got to get down here. You got to see this. What is it? No, you got to see this. No, seriously, Tristan, what is it? I'm in a meeting right now. No, come down here and see this. The audience will not find out for another 5 minutes. I love it.
I know. But let's remember who created this show, right? Brannon Braga. So The Expanse is basically, it's Brannon Braga incarnate in space. It's the weird shit region.
Yes, that's very true.
Brannon Braga is The Expanse.
So anyway.
That's what we should call him from now on.
There we go.
This anomaly, it impacts the ship. And then Archer ends up in sickbay. And we find out that this anomaly has somehow deposited several parasites into his brain.
Yes, temporal parasites.
Temporal parasites.
Interspatial parasites.
Yes. And I was just expecting Dr. Pulaski to walk in, ask Phlox to leave the room, and then strap Archer down and make him relive the first 2 seasons of Enterprise.
That would have been,
and he had gray hair at the beginning, so it was like this literally is Shades of Gray.
Very true.
It would have been even more awesome if he had to relive the first 2 seasons of The Next Generation. Now that would have been an episode.
Nice.
Somebody should do that.
I'm sure there's a non-canon novel where that has been done already.
I'm not sure if Archer, though, had enough like romantic encounters to do the romantic encounters part of Shades of Grey. One disappointment about Archer, I always thought he'd be sleeping with more ladies all around the universe.
Yeah.
I think Tripp got it on more often.
I think he did.
I think so.
Yeah.
All right. So
anyway,
moving on from here, moving on. We quickly learn, how it happened later on, but we see in the beginning that T'Pol is now in command.
Right.
Now, what did you think about T'Pol as captain of the ship? Because she's typically, even at this point in the series, she's still rather Vulcan-like, but the decisions that she was making here as captain were very un-Vulcan-like, I thought. Especially the part where she said, "Prepare for ramming speed."
Yes. Today is a logical day to die. I have a theory that Vulcans don't make good captains. I'm sure this probably make a lot of people angry. But even, I mean, Mirror Spock said it in Mirror Mirror that he had really no desire to be a captain. He liked the science part of things. But it reminded me of like when Adama was in sickbay because he'd been shot and Ty took over and just everything went to hell immediately.
So say we all!
He was trying really hard, but Ty just is not a commander. And the stuff T'Pol was doing, I mean, obviously, we can't blame her for Earth exploding, but obviously, if T'Pol's not in command, Earth doesn't explode. So, I mean, correlation, causation, all of that. All that to say, yeah, T'Pol had some...
It's kind of like how we can't blame Deanna for crashing the ship kind of thing.
Right, but she was piloting the ship when it crashed into a planet, and that hadn't happened in 7 seasons of the show. The first time you put her at the... Anyway. No, what did you think of Captain T'Pol, Tristan?
I think that she was wearing way too much clothing. I really think that they really needed to just take the pips, you know, and maybe put it on her normal clothing. And
right.
Then maybe that's what should happen. No, I'm just kidding. No, I just thought it was weird to see her in that outfit
because we only
get these skin-tight outfits. It was like 7 of 9 with pips on.
Well, those Enterprise uniforms are not very flattering to the female officers.
No.
You know, at least...
No.
In the 23rd, 24th century, they kind of... The Starfleet Fashion School, which we talk about quite often in the Ready Room.
Yes.
They really kind of got their act together.
Yeah, I want to go on a little tangent, just real quick. Okay, so Enterprise, we have pips. And then once we get to the original series, we have stripes. And then in kind of the Kirk movie era... with Wrath of Khan on, we get like these weird design clusters and then we go back to pips. I mean, what's up with that?
Well, pips are easier. You know, when you want to resign your commission because you don't agree with the decisions of the council,
yeah.
It's much easier to take the pips off and put them on the table. Because if you have to take the stripes off, it's really hard. I mean, can you see Picard like ripping the stripes off of his sleeves and throwing them down on the table? And saying,
it's just like,
how many does it take before it's wrong?
And he's just like trying to like pull it out, like pull the string by string, like unraveling.
Then he walks out of the ready room,
his entire sleeve.
Yes. And his sleeves are there's like
it's
thread
like
hanging off the sleeves.
He's sort of walking
there. We
out
go. You guys just answered that question. That's why we went back to pips, because it's easier to resign. So to go back to the earlier question, I think Greg, you're spot on, is that there's some people who make great XOs, horrible captains.
Yeah.
I don't think Kira would make a good captain,
No. But
I think she makes a great XO.
Yeah.
I think Riker is a great XO, and he would make an amazing captain. I think he proved that in The Best of Both Worlds. But, you know, and like you said, Mirror Spock at least, said, you know, he wasn't interested in it. So you can go back and forth. I mean, there are some people who are career XOs or move on to something else.
I think the real question we need to answer is the XO of the Enterprise F, is he captain material?
I don't know. I think the real question is, you know, is he canonical? I think is the word that's appropriate. I think that's what they call it.
Yeah, but you have a good point. Yeah, I mean, some people are great XOs, but not great captains.
Yeah, so like I said, I don't want to put the whole blame on T'Pol, but yeah, but what is she doing when she like rams the one Zindi ship with the other Zindi ship while it's still connected.
I love that Trip gave her crap for that.
Yeah.
I love that he spoke up and said, what the hell were you thinking?
Yeah, that's what we needed last episode. You know, after Janeway gets the ship caught in the tachyon field, we need a Trip there. What the hell are you doing, Catherine?
Well, what T'Pol was doing, though, is she was giving us some spectacular CGI moments.
That's very true. That's very true. I like the camera sort of rigged to the nacelle. That was very... Actually, this whole episode feels like a Battlestar Galactica episode.
So say we all.
But that shot in particular...
It does.
...really feels like it.
I love on Enterprise, when something happens to the nacelles like this, the smoke streaming out of the nacelles... Yeah. I mean, the nacelles, they really look real. It's like, this is a real ship. A lot of people hate the NX-01, but I think the NX-01 is a fantastic design because that's a ship that I feel like I can go out and touch and see that ship. It's like something that we would really build this ship.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I feel like if we were going to, if we were going to, as the world, would build a ship of this caliber, that's what it would look like.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's what they were going for. It felt like it merged, I don't know, futuristic NASA to, you know, what we perceive as, you know, Federation Star Trek ships.
It did a great job of bridging everything.
Yeah.
I think you're right, Chris. I think it's great.
I mean, I would have liked to see the refit where they add more of a TOS-style engineering section at the bottom with a...
Yeah.
Whatever they... What's the thing that's being delivered next Tuesday, Chris?
The deflector dish.
Deflector array.
Yeah. So, yes. I would have liked to see that in the mythical season 5. But the ship as it is fantastic, and I love that they are not using stock shots every week. That it's always new footage that they're using.
Yeah. Which of course, I mean, financially, it was possible when Enterprise was being made. It wasn't really possible.
Oh, sure.
TNG was being made, but I have a question for you guys here, though. Now. Again, I'm not a warp theorist. I'm not a warp engineer. I'm not a Lieutenant Argyle. Yes. But after T'Pol just blows the crap out of the nacelle and it's streaming smoke and it's just been shattered, it's like the Reliant's nacelle in the Wrath of Khan after they blow it a torpedo through it the first time. And Trip tells her that the best we can do right now is warp 1.7. Now, I may be wrong here, but isn't the reason that there are two nacelles because they're required in order to create a warp bubble in the first place? How can you go warp 0.7 when one of your nacelles is non-functional?
I think I have an answer for that.
Okay. Oh, wow.
Okay. In the Star Trek Voyager episode Message in a Bottle, there was the USS Prometheus that could separate into three hulls. Mm-hmm. Little known fact, you actually see it in the screen, but the top portion has no nacelles. Like there's three portions. There's the top portion, midsection, and lower section. Lower section and midsection each have two nacelles. And the top section, you can't see any side nacelles, but what happens is a small nacelle lowers from the hull out of a kind of a torpedo bay like thing, kind of like at the bottom of a Star Destroyer from Star Wars, comes out, and then that's able to give it very minimum warp. So if for some reason the lower sections get destroyed, it's not stranded on impulse. So it is possible to have warp on one nacelle, but I doubt it would be very safe, and I doubt that you'd be able to have a very cohesive warp bubble.
Interesting. So you create like a very weak warp bubble with just one. That's actually quite interesting.
Okay. That makes sense.
The more you know.
I've just noticed that, and certainly I thought that, well, of course, someone can create a technology to create warp travel without having two nacelles, because you see other alien races in Star Trek have different configurations.
Right, and the Vulcans sort of have the warp ring.
And the Romulans
just has a thruster on the back.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, I love how the Bird of Prey can go at high warp with just the thruster on the back.
Let's not attack the Klingon Board of Engineers. They're very particular. They have detailed plans.
I know. We've already been on their case enough during news. I think what it boils down to is that they couldn't put proper nacelles on a bird of prey, because if they did, it threw off the whole explosion sequence.
They tried to put nacelles on it, but then the bridge kept exploding like second rather than last, and it just wasn't. God.
So they had to take it off. Yeah. But in Starfleet design, going all the way back to the Phoenix Zefram Cochrane, they have always used this configuration of two nacelles jutting out. The most noticeable exception being the Defiant, which has them on the sides and has the ablative armor around them.
Right.
But, and it's not a good design. I mean, if the nacelles get damaged, you're pretty much screwed. Yeah. So if I were an engineer, I would not make my nacelles jut outwards from the ship.
Well, they must have figured it out. I mean, it's like aircraft wings where they, you know, you started out and you made a wing a certain shape because it, you know, made the air, but then you figured out, well, if you're going fast enough, you can make it slightly different. You can make them swept back. There's different stuff you can do, but in general, it works better if the wings are pointed out away from a fuselage. I mean, there's different designs too. And there's like fixed wing aircraft that's just one big flying wing. But I think what they basically figured out is it creates the best warp bubble if they've got a fuselage and then the nacelle sticking out, even though, as you say, it's awfully risky because they're just sticking out there.
Plus, you can make them go up and down as well. And don't you think it's a missed opportunity on Voyager that they didn't have more plot lines in which the nacelles get jammed? Yes. And like they can't get out of warp because the nacelles are jammed.
Yeah, I would have.
They send Neelix out there to like push it.
I want to see Neelix with the, you know, with a wrench just banging on it, and I can't quite get to warp. Come on, Neelix, do it. You can. Yeah.
Oh, there was like going back to Abrams' Trek, the Kelvin. It only had one nacelle.
Is that true?
I think it just has one that's sticking out.
It was all just for shuttles.
You're absolutely right. I need to look at that again. Yeah. Well, they must have had a really, really crappy warp bubble.
Well, but as we've already talked about in news, you know, they do amazing things with transporter technology in the Abrams verse. So I think they probably can do amazing things with warp technology as well.
That's true.
I like how warp 1.7 is like, really? Warp 1.7. That's like faster than light, guys. Now, warp 1.7, that's not going to do us any good. No, literally, it's faster than the speed of light. It's warp 1.7. Seriously, that's not going to get us. We can go from one planet to another planet in like less than a day. It's warp 1.7. Get over yourself.
Yeah.
What are we, Amish? Yeah, what's going on?
Horse-drawn carriages. Warp 1.7.
Why didn't they do an Amish episode on Enterprise?
They really should have.
Where they have to transport a group of Amish from one planet to another planet.
But no, screw that. Let's make them Irish.
Okay. Really should not talk about the Irish anymore.
Let's not make them
we're
Irish.
We're treading in some bad water already with the Irish today.
Greg has already done his Irish imitation today.
Not part of my personal canon anymore, Chris. Let's not speak of it. Anyway, so they can only go warp 1.7, so they have to create this ragtag fugitive fleet as they're flying away from the remains of Earth. And this is where the show does become Battlestar Enterprise.
It completely becomes Battlestar Enterprise at this point. I mean, the shot of the fleet approaching New Caprica was really well done. And
I really like the part where Captain Baltar... brings in like his captain's women and starts drinking, and then it's 1 year later and they're settled on new SETI Alpha 5.
I thought it was a total ripoff though, because when they started posting the number of survivors in space, you know, just numerically, but I don't know. But didn't the writer actually like get a hold of the pilot script for BSG and make an homage to this?
That's
like,
in Memory Alpha.
This was an intended homage. Yeah.
Right. Well, of course, the original Battlestar had been around, and then, this even presages, as Chris says, the season two storyline of New Caprica. It's quite similar, actually.
It is, especially the part where T'Pol puts on extra weight and grows a beard.
Yes, I really liked that part of the episode.
Tristan is looking like he missed that part. Tristan,
I definitely missed that part.
I would actually like to see, like we talk about Year of Hell, like if that could have been a really cool season of Voyager. This could be a cool sort of like what if series of Star Trek. Like, let's do a series of Star Trek where Earth got destroyed, and just do it all in this parallel universe, and let's really explore all the different facets of it. Because
I think Ron Moore already did that, though.
Well, he does it after this, certainly. But I love it. I mean, we're bouncing around, and, you know, T'Pol's reading from her notebook and talking about it, so we don't see it really completely linearly, and we don't see all of the pieces of it. But I guess, like, last week, I was sort of complaining that we only see these little vignettes and it's not connected.
Yeah.
This one, because we're focused on Archer, we get to see his reaction to these events. And then in the events themselves, we get to see T'Pol's journey as a character. It's a really, really good job of doing this concept. I don't know how they could have done this concept any better.
Right. This is what you wanted last week. Right?
Exactly.
This is focused on the characters, even though we're jumping through time over a period of 12 years. Yeah.
Speaking of jumping through time, has anyone else noticed that Star Trek ages their characters way too fast?
Yeah.
I mean, in every iteration of the series, I mean, from TOS to ENT, everybody, like, whenever 10 years passes, it looks like 30 years has passed for every single character.
Well, unless you're William Shatner. What was the episode, you're good with this, Chris, where they get aged and, like, McCoy looks like his face is about to fall off from all the wrinkles?
The Deadly Years.
And Shatner looks like maybe... Shatner's hairline recedes a little bit, and then it comes back as he gets even older. His hairline advances. He has male pattern hair growth.
That's because as the years go by for him, you know, hair growth technology and treatment advances.
Right.
So
even
speaking
when he's
of
got
hair,
some crazy disease.
Now, coming back to Twilight here.
Yes.
Speaking of hair, did you guys notice that over the course of this 12-year period in Twilight that Phlox slowly turns into a woman?
I know. Yeah, I actually love the evolution of Phlox's hairstyle. It just gets longer and curlier as it goes.
Exactly.
I didn't see what you guys saw.
Really?
I liked it. I thought he looked learned and wise.
Did he?
With this hairstyle.
By the end, he's got these locks that are like falling past his shoulder with great little curls at the end. And he was just glowing. His face was so radiant.
Right. I did like how Travis had added a streak of silver to his hair.
Well, you were watching really closely, Greg, because the first time I watched this, I was like, you know, Travis was not even in this episode. And then the second time I realized, no, he does have a few speaking lines.
Does he really? I missed them completely. I tried to watch the episode again. I didn't notice.
But you know where
didn't
he's
he
not?
Die?
You know where he's not? Another thing I thought about in this episode was this is the episode where everyone gets to be a captain.
Yes, this is very true.
T'Pol's the captain, then Trip is the captain, Malcolm is just promoted to captain, and then there's that scene where Archer thinks, well, maybe Hoshi's a captain too. No, I'm not a captain, I'm still here. And then I'm thinking, what about Travis? But no screen time for Travis. There's no Travis.
Travis is still an ensign.
Think about how boring that captaincy would be. They just circle the system. That's it.
Yeah.
That's all they do. Was I the only one who thought about that? Like, for 12 years,
well, I mean,
you're going in a circle.
Surely every once in a while, you know, a space pirate shows up, you have to scare them away. I mean, they're doing stuff. It's sort of like the Defiant on DS9, where it's there to do stuff and go on little missions. But it's nothing like the actual charter of the Enterprise, where they're to seek out strange new worlds. They found a strange new world, and now they're just going to sit there. It's got to be really depressing.
I think what you're trying to say is, this is City Alpha 5!
Yes. Yes, Tristan.
Exactly. Okay, sorry. I'm sorry. Okay. I just wanted to be clear.
Okay. We're very clear on that.
Okay,
which
I'm sorry.
Planet?
I'm sorry.
People might think we're joking. It kind of flew by me the very first time I saw this episode back in, whenever it was, 2003, 2004. But yeah, it is a pretty blatant joke that it's SETI Alpha 5 that they landed on, and that in another, 60 years? No, well, I guess like 100
years.
Another 100 years, that planet is going to get screwed up when the sun explodes or whatever happens.
Because humans just can't catch a break.
No.
Exactly. Right, yeah. They destroy Earth, they destroy Mars, they destroy Alpha Centauri and Delta Vega. And now the remaining 6,000 humans settle on a planet that we know is going to be destroyed, or at least not destroyed, but rendered virtually uninhabitable.
Right. Yeah. I'm really hoping that in the next Star Trek movie, the remnants of the Vulcan civilization haven't also settled on SETI Alpha 5. Like, it's the designated, let's go ahead and put refugees there planet.
it's like, you know, here in Japan, we have signs everywhere for the evacuation centers.
Yes, yes.
If there's an earthquake, you know, every community, there are many designated spots where you're supposed to go. And it's kind of like that. It's like floating. There are space buoys everywhere that point to SETI Alpha 5. It's like, in case your planet is blown up, please make your way to SETI Alpha 5.
Right. And you just know somebody got fired at the Federation. Like, why did you pick SETI Alpha 5? It's obvious that the sun was unstable.
It sounds like a plot line from Hitchhiker's Guide to the
That's
Galaxy.
True. It does.
All right. Well, let's talk about kind of the way that this resolves itself. So,
yeah.
Greg, you sent me a message and you said, and there's the giant reset button.
Yeah. Because it appears. They tech the tech and tech the tech some more, and they figure out that they can get rid of the temporal parasites if they blow everything up, which that's got to be the best, right? That's the best solution for anything. If we can fix the plot by blowing everything up, that's got to make you happy. You got that great shot of the bridge being blown out into space.
That is a great shot.
Really cool
that
shot.
That was amazing.
And then we've got the warp core exploding as well.
That raised a big question for me. Why in the 23rd or 24th century do enemies not use that tactic of blowing the bridge out into space more often?
Yeah,
is it like an understood thing that you don't blow up each other's bridges or what? Because the Zindi went straight for it and basically just cut the bridge off, ripped the roof off,
and
blew it out into space.
Yeah, I mean, you got to figure there's extra shielding there. They're trying to make sure that the bridge is protected. I don't personally know why the bridge has to be there rather than deep inside of the ship, other than that it's
awfully
cinematic.
Let's put the bridge in the most... Well, it's very cinematic. You want that great, you know, view of the stars above your head.
Right.
You want that sunlight coming into the bridge.
You've got that moonroof. You know, you paid extra at the dealership for the moonroof.
I think later on, I think it might be fourth season where Trip and Malcolm are on a Romulan ship, but they don't know that it's a Romulan ship. It's that chameleon ship, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
And they're talking about, they're like, okay, let's make our way to the bridge. And Trip says, if we're assuming that the bridge is on the top,
right?
You know, I was like, that's kind of when it first occurred to me, like, why do we design ships this way?
It's the same thing on...
people are just going to cut it out.
Same thing on Nemesis. I mean, they beam... Well, no, sorry, it's Star Trek 09. They beam the Romulan films, confuse me. They beam to what's probably like a cargo bay or something, and it turns out that's where the bridge is. It's like, they don't put the bridge necessarily where you think it would be, because, it doesn't make sense. I did wonder, maybe the battle bridge is deep inside the ship somewhere where it's protected.
I think the battle bridge is better protected,
So they're finally starting to think, even though they never use the battle bridge, but at least the concept is there.
Do you think Argyle sneaks through the Jefferies tubes and hangs out on the battle bridge? Because they don't use the battle bridge very often.
He's just pretending. He's pretending to be captain. Yeah, Vigo! Just hanging out with some gin.
That's where he keeps his snacks.
He's got posters up on the walls.
Yeah.
I bet the place is like a pigsty.
Oh, I bet it is. There's like beer cans all over the floor. Haven't
Cheetos
done the dishes
in the L cars.
Oh, all right. But what were we talking about?
I was talking about
the reset button.
The reset button.
Everything up, and it vaporizes the Phlox figures it out, you know, in the last minute. But it's great. I mean, this is one case I don't think Braga actually wrote this episode, right? Because typically this would be a Braga situation.
He did not. This, Michael Sussman wrote this episode.
Sussman actually wrote it. Where they get to, like, we have no idea what we're going to do now. So let's just tech the tech and make it work. But this is actually a pretty good logical reset button. I mean, for what it is, I mean, if we blow them up here, they sort of exist outside of space-time. So if we blow them up here, they're blown up everywhere. So it would reset the timeline. Sure, I completely buy that, actually. I'm not angry at all. It completely works for me.
Yeah, I was, I like you, Greg, I was completely satisfied with this ending. And I like that, like, as opposed to Year of Hell, where Janeway, it was kind of like an afterthought at the end of the episode. Like, maybe this whole year wouldn't have happened. Like, no, in this episode of Twilight, they said, okay, no, we found this out. This will be a reset button.
Right.
Let's punch it, and let's punch it hard. And that was their goal.
They even set it up first, like, well, you know, obviously, if we had an antimatter explosion, it would fix everything. Although I don't know if they knew at the time that it would reset it everywhere, but they did know this would kill the parasites. So they set it up earlier in the show. It didn't come out of nowhere, you know, that Braga ex machina that happens. It was actually set up early on.
Right.
Yeah, this one worked for me. I don't really consider it a reset button so much because of the fact that I view this as one possible outcome of the Zindi conflict. I never took this, even from the first time I watched it, as the actual outcome of the Zindi conflict, but merely it's possible. It's kind of like in Carbon Creek when T'Pol says, "Let me tell you a story."
Yeah.
It's like, she's telling Archer the story. This is what happened. And so when they get to the end of it, I feel like, yeah, maybe this happened, maybe it didn't, but we just go back. Unlike Year of Hell, which was foreshadowed earlier in Voyager, and then Year of Hell actually happened. They actually encountered that region of space, and things played out as you kind of expected they would. And then at the end, they really did hit a reset button.
Yeah,
that to me, I felt, was a reset button.
Yeah.
The similarity to me between the Year of Hell reset button and all the reset buttons and this one is that the characters don't advance at all. T'Pol never has this experience where Archer lays down his life for her. Archer never experiences T'Pol caring for him, you know, cooking his breakfast and washing his clothes. He never has that experience. They never have the realization of what would happen if the Zindi blew up Earth. They get reset. It's back to as they were day before. And that's the same as Year of Hell. None of them figure it out at all. They don't have that. The difference for me, and I think this is what you're getting at, is that the viewer is changed. Whereas in Year of Hell, at the end of it, you're like, well, why did I bother with any of that? At the end of this episode, you're like, okay, that's why we have to stop the Zindi. Because if we don't, they're going to blow up Earth. We're going to end up on SETI Alpha 5. And Archer's going to end up sleeping with T'Pol. And that's really weird. So let's...
And that can't happen.
Let's really avoid that happening. So the viewers change. And it changes the show going forward, even though it is a what-if scenario.
That's a good point. Yeah, okay. I think that is what I'm getting at. And I think that's why I felt like the positioning of this within the third season was good. Because it made us more invested in what was going to happen in the Zindi conflict, because it really defined the stakes, and we knew that that danger was still there through the end. Whereas in Year of Hell, there was no real danger. I mean, I suppose that if Anorax kept changing the timeline, that it could affect at some point maybe the whole galaxy or something, but it mainly was impacting our one ship at that point. But here we know that, you know, the human race could be destroyed.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So that's where, at the end of the episode, I'm feeling like I was changed, even if no one... they did mention that they tried to figure out a way to have Archer retain some of his memories, but it just never quite worked. It didn't ever make sense. And I'm glad they didn't try that, because... I always hate that moment where it's usually Guinan or Troy who's like, yeah, things just are different now, or, oh, you should have been there for that stuff that we experienced.
Well, Well, don't forget, the difference between Guinan and Troy is that Guinan actually knows things, and Troy just kind of vaguely thinks that something might be the case.
That's very true.
Well, you got to ask yourselves, what would he remember? Because he would forget it every day. So would he remember that one day that we saw, or would he remember all of the days previously, or... You know, it just raised too many questions.
Yep. He would just remember, he would remember the first time he slept with T'Pol before the parasites fully took effect.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Now, I think it would
probably
be,
wrote it down.
You'd want it to be T'Pol that remembered, honestly, because she's the one who would then have a deeper appreciation for her captain. I'm sorry. but again, because she wasn't the one having the parasites in her head, it wouldn't make any sense for her to remember it other than just to be a quick writer's device.
Yeah. Maybe Travis should have been the one that remembered everything, because it wouldn't have affected the crew at that point.
Character something to do.
You wouldn't believe what just happened. Well, it didn't happen, but it could have happened to you guys. Like, I have all these memories. Wouldn't you like to hear about them? Shut up, Travis.
Nobody cares. Nobody believes them. It's like when Fry and Futurama save the world and no one cares.
Oh, all right. So I guess that takes us pretty much to the end of the episode. Mm-hmm. I mentioned the Shades of Grey feeling. Of course, we've talked about the Europale, and we've talked about the All Good Things. And I really, the ending of this for me this time was very much All Good Things, all the way to the point of when the Enterprise has to explode. Like, all three of the Enterprises have to explode in order for the timeline to be set right again. And it was pretty much the same thing here, where
in general,
in All Good Things,
the Federation starship has to explode to reset the timeline. I mean, if we want to talk about tropes, that's how it goes.
It's the way they build these things. And, you know, in All Good Things, they're having to hold on to the bitter end. They have to hold on to that last second. And here you've got this Zindi reptilian who's repeatedly shooting Archer, but somehow he still manages to have enough strength to pull each lever.
Right.
So that he can finally blow everything up. Yes.
You always have enough strength to pull that last lever.
And then it blows up, and then it goes back to the close-up of Archer's face, just like we get the close-up of Picard spiraling in the courtroom at the end of All Good Things.
Yeah. Yeah.
The only difference is we don't have spectacular dialogue between John Delancey and Patrick Stewart at the end of the episode, like we do in All Good Things.
That was gorgeous. Was there a time when the Defiant blew up for a reset?
Probably.
Because Voyager did it.
Actually,
the D did it. Yeah. NX did it.
Well, the Defiance definitely has been blown up.
But,
of course, a difference with the Defiant is they blew up the Defiant and they made it count.
That's
again,
true.
Yeah,
the Defiant actually
Deep Space
blew up.
Nine.
Yeah.
The Defiant really was destroyed and it didn't magically come back.
I know in Children of Time it crashed and that did a reset or something.
We need
like
to do that
episode.
That's
like the closest one.
Because I don't know how you guys feel about Children of Time. For me, that was always my least favorite episode of Deep Space Nine.
I love that episode.
In fact,
for
many years, it was not even part of my canon.
I rewatched that one a lot, actually.
I need to rewatch it. We should do that one.
We'll put that one on the dock, because I don't think I remember that one either. I think, in general, if it's a time travel episode, it's more likely that I'm going to just not remember it going forward, even when it's a quality one like this.
Not exactly a time travel episode, though.
It's not quite.
Children, it's not exactly time. It's not the classic time travel trope anyway.
Yeah.
All right. So we get to the end here. I was fully expecting, and I think I even tweeted this. I hope our followers know that we're not serious all the time, because I actually did tweet T'Pol, quote, "It's the chicken and the egg. The chicken and the egg."
Right.
"We think it started in the past, but it didn't. It started right here in the future." Twilight.
All right, how about we go back to bed, Chris?
No, it's...
I was expecting... I mean, it was just leading up to that. The whole thing about we have to destroy the parasites here, and it will destroy them in the past.
And then somebody just screams, "We have to save humanity!"
That was Travis. He was off camera. He's like, "I'm going to get in this episode somehow."
And Christopher Lloyd shows up.
We must go back to the future.
It's about your kids, Marty.
Okay. All right. Well, I think we're at the end. Any final thoughts on Twilight?
Well, my main thought is that Warp 1.7 is awfully disappointing. I mean, if Federation scientists, if that's really the best they can do on one nacelle, they really need to go back to the drawing board.
Really? Because couldn't Cochrane do better than that with two nacelles?
Right. It was like the first warp ship, and he was already going. And this is like hundreds of years later, and that's all they can do. Or 100 years later.
100 years later.
Speaking of Cochrane, I love that he killed a Zindi with the Cochrane statue that Geordi talks about in First Contact. That's fantastic.
That's continuity for you right there. That's phenomenal.
He's like, he's sort of reaching out into the future and in your frickin' face.
Perfect. Yeah. So in general, I really enjoyed this episode. I didn't, as I said to Tristan, I didn't remember it. Perhaps I had some temporal parasites in my head as well. But it pretty much works for me on all the levels. It's up there with Regeneration as Enterprise episodes that just move for me. And it's astonishing because this is a season 3 episode and I pretty much hate season 3. So the fact that they snuck this one in and it was a recycled Voyager script as well. Makes it very surprising. But yeah, if any of our listeners have gotten this far and haven't ever seen Twilight or haven't seen it in a while, go back and check it out. You don't have to watch any of the other Zindi stuff. Just pick this one out. It's some quality TV.
I differ with Greg in the respect of liking season 3. I actually really enjoy the Zindi story arc, and I like that this episode ups the ante. Like, this is the ultimate raise the stakes. Like, Chris, you said earlier, this episode shows us if Archer and his crew fail, we're all doomed. You know, this is, Earth is destroyed, and we see it happen. It's not just, oh, well, you know, it may or may not happen. No, this is going to happen if they fail. And I really like the character interaction. I like Trip talking to DePaul. I like Phlox still being in contact with everyone and being a friend to humanity. I like that we got to see Mirror Malcolm, you know, with his goatee.
What was Mirror Malcolm doing on the ship? By the way, I like that.
But no, I just loved everything about it. I love that Meriwether wasn't in it that much. I think that's great. Or Mayweather, excuse me.
Whatever his name is. Writers don't know.
It doesn't matter. Yeah, he might well be wearing a red shirt. But no, this is probably my favorite episode of Enterprise, and I'm glad that we're talking about it.
Yeah, it is still one of my favorites. I will say that I didn't love the episode as much now as I did back in 2003, but I totally agree with both of you guys on it. And it's still one of my favorite episodes. Regeneration, it was a great one. Carbon Creek is an episode I really love as well. And I think, you know, I'd probably give this one maybe 9 Vulcan haircuts.
I was going to give it Warp Factor 1.7, actually.
But it's on a 2 scale.
Right.
So.
I mean, that's really high up in the scale I'm using. I mean,
it is high up.
This is the scale based on only having one nacelle. So if you think of it on that scale, 1.7 is pretty good. I mean, very disappointing, but kind of good.
Oh. All right. Well, Tristan, thanks as always for joining us. And of course, everyone can catch you on Hyper Channel every week. I hope they're doing that.
Absolutely. If you're not, you should, because it is for the Trekkie on the go, as Matt Hansen told me.
That's right. You can measure your travel time in hyperchannels.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Which is also what a friend of the show, Ben McCormick, said as well. Also, Tristan, now Greg had a good idea. Tell me what you think about this. At the intro of Hyperchannel, we really think that we need to rewrite a little bit.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. All right.
And say, Helling frequencies are open. I'm your host, international sex symbol, Tristan Riddell. And this is your Trek FM Hyper Channel.
You need to just reshoot all of those openings with that new script.
I like just, yeah, every week I'll just, I'll introduce that, but I'll phrase it like I'm, for some reason, I have a cigar and a brandy in my hand. Like, the lights are much lower.
Yeah, never mind
much
this
lower
whole,
than they should be.
Never mind this whole like tech looking set with like the screen behind you. No, you're like in a comfy like leather chair with a smoking jacket and
a burgundy dinner jacket. Yes. Absolutely.
And at the end of the episode, when you come back on, you'll say, "For Trek FM, I'm Tristan Riddell. Stay thirsty, my friends." And I'll see you next week.
At the beginning, I gotta be a little bit more aggressive at it. Just like Star Trek Hyper Channel coming at you. You know, something like that.
Perfect.
You know? All right. Well, apart from Hyper Channel, tell everyone where they can find you on the internets, Tristan.
Oh, yeah. Like, apart from Hyper Channel, you can find me mostly on this newfangled device called Twitter, username at the Insane Robin. I'm on it all the time. I love talking Star Trek on Twitter. That's pretty much all that I do, except for talking Batman. And around 10:30 a.m. Central Time, that's usually when I give the Star Trek question of the day. And please chime in, answer, get conversation going. I'll retweet all the answers. Hopefully you'll find somebody that you haven't followed that you like what they said, and we can all be friends and, you know, sleep in a big huddle like a bunch of baby cats.
Another thing for us to do at Star Trek Las Vegas.
Absolutely. All right, well, we've released the docking clamps on the ISS Tristan Riddell, and he's floating off into space on a new voyage to explore strange new worlds. Always glad to have him on the show. I think I didn't actually know. This is his favorite Enterprise episode. And it's up there for me too, after watching it this week.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. I was surprised to hear that. I was actually thinking that, does Tristan really like Enterprise or not? Because, you know, we usually get Brian on for our Enterprise episodes.
I know.
So we usually end up coming across as Enterprise haters when we actually really like the series.
We do. I wonder what Brian would have had to say. I know we had the spirit of Charlene was with us today, but we never really had the spirit of Brian Finifter. He probably would have had something negative to say about the episode. I'm not sure what it was, though, because I love this episode so much.
Yeah, I'm not sure, but there would have been something. That much I know for certain. But it was fun to talk about this. It was another great moment in Enterprise. I do, again, as we always say, encourage people to go watch Enterprise. Enough time has passed. You know, you don't have to hate the series because it wasn't a continuation of Voyager. Yeah. And that time period, just go watch it. There are some great moments in there. And speaking of that, Greg, why don't we just go ahead and tell everyone where they can contact us if they want to share their thoughts on Twilight, on Enterprise, on anything else that we talked about today. You can just go to trek.fm/contact. You can find our contact form there. That will come directly to my inbox as an email, which is very convenient for me. But you can also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. On Google Plus at hyperchannel/TrekFMG+. And of course, you can find us on Twitter at username TrekFM, which is where we are talking about Star Trek with listeners and followers and fans of the franchise around the clock. Both Greg and I are talking. Also, Charlene and Drew are tweeting from that account as well. So there's someone pretty much wherever you are in the world, whatever time of day, at this point, we have someone on the Trek FM account who can talk Trek with you.
Yeah, definitely. I love following the Trek FM account, especially, I think Charlene was talking about Tuvix today.
Yeah.
And I maybe want to go back and watch Tuvix again. But yeah, I can also be found on the Twitters at Greg Harbin, GregHarbin. Right now, just to get everybody caught up, I'm season 2 of Doctor Who. I'm season 5 of DS9. And I'm watching just random TOS episodes with one of our listeners. So I might talk about a piece of the action or Mirror Mirror. You never know which TOS episode I'm going to watch. And actually, I'm looking for suggestions. If anybody has a favorite TOS episode, I'm really enjoying going back and watching it. But I don't like watching TOS in order. I don't know if you have that experience, Chris.
It's a
weird sort of series where I like jumping around.
I always jump around in TOS. I don't really see very much point in watching the series in order because there really isn't any effort to make any continuity flow from story to story. So I don't feel like, you know, if I watch a third season episode and then I go back and watch a first season episode, I just feel like I'm just watching TOS. You know, I don't feel like I've missed anything. I don't feel like I need to know what came before.
Right.
Anything like that.
Yeah, it's not like there's a Zindi arc that shows up in the third season of TOS that you have to sort of be knowledgeable about the lead up to.
That's right. Yeah. All right. Well, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. I am back up, as I mentioned last week, to full speed tweeting like I used to be. I'm watching my tweet count climb very rapidly. Mm-hmm. Of course, I'm tweeting about Star Trek. When I tweet about my personal life, I try to put a Star Trek twist on it just to keep everyone entertained and not bore everyone to death. Of course, I'm going to be tweeting about college football a bit now as the season has started as well. And hopefully, Greg will contribute to that with his incredible insight into the sports ball. And if he does...
Are we going to start that? We're going to start that podcast?
I think so. I think we need a Monday podcast that we record where you and I recap all the college football action from the weekend. Because, you know, ESPN, they do a good job, but no one can really bring the flavor to the game the way you can, Greg.
I just think it's important that Michigan realizes how much foot strength they have and really try to capitalize that and see if they can. I don't know. I keep checking the rule book. If you do a field goal from further back, like 60, 70 yards, is it like baseball? Is it like basketball? You can get like more points, like 4 or 5 points out of that. I feel like Michigan, they're not so good with the touching down in the score area, but with the feet advantage they have, I really think they could post a lot of score points.
They're probably lobbying the NCAA for a rule change right now.
Probably.
After that game in Dallas this weekend. But all right. Well, let's let everyone get out of here. So thanks for listening to another long show. Please go over to the site, trek.fm, catch all of our other podcasts, all of our games, our articles, all kinds of stuff going on there. And we will see you next week. So, Greg, I'm going to go wander off now. My hair's getting a little bit long. I'm going to ask T'Pol to give me a haircut.
All right, Chris. I think it's time to stick a Zephyr Cochran statue in it. Because the Ready Room is done.